Well, good morning to all of you. My plan is to share a message called Wrapping It Up. So for those of you who have been here regularly, I have been preaching through Genesis through the lives of the patriarchs. And so this is Genesis chapter 50. So we've gotten to the end of the book. So it's been a long journey. I don't remember when I started. I told Milo I throw my sermons away when I get done with them. So I never know when I start something or when I get it done. But some of you all can probably remember in that distant past. It was BC, right? So maybe not quite that long ago. But wrapping it up. So this is like taking a present and you... I don't know, if you're like me, you're not very careful with how you wrap things. You just sort of put some tape on it, and you put paper around it, and then you kind of twist the corners down and put more tape on it, and eventually it looks like a package. And some people actually would put a bow on it. They put like little ribbon around it, and they tie it nicely, and I never do that because it wouldn't hide the fact that I don't know what I'm doing when it comes to wrapping paper. Somehow I've lived this long, and I still don't know how to wrap things right. But hopefully, at the end of this, we're going to have wrapped up Genesis. So there won't be anything more to say about it. So if you all think of something else, it's just probably wrong, okay? Just, that's a joke. So, satisfaction guaranteed. So I see this label on a lot of items. So you've probably noticed cereal, soap. I even found this label on some spaghetti that we had in our pantry. And most of the time, the label says something about how if you don't like something, that you can bring it back to the store and they'll either replace it or give you your money back. They don't actually tell you that they'll give you satisfaction. They just tell you that you don't have to use the product, which I guess is almost as good. And I think there's more than this. The world around us claims that certain things are going to bring us satisfaction. It might be the style of clothes we wear. It might be the amount of money we have in the bank. It might be our appearance. And an awful lot of people spend money on what they think is going to give them satisfaction. Some people even have surgery to try to make themselves more beautiful. And they think that their life will be better if they do this. And the answer is that none of these things bring satisfaction. A lot of people have spent a lot of money pursuing something that is not gained through money. And this might be an odd place to start, but Genesis 50 is the end of the book of Genesis. It's a wrapping up place as well as a starting place for the book of Exodus. And I think at the end of his life, Joseph was satisfied. He'd lived his life, he'd suffered much, he'd made a lot of friends along the way, but he had no regrets. And that's the sort of life that I think all of us want to live. And maybe it's something that we struggle with. As we get older, we feel like there's more life behind us than there is in front. And maybe that has its own set of challenges, because whatever you've done already is done. There's no going back. You don't have a time machine where you can go back and change those kinds of things. And so we're going to be thinking about legacy this morning. That's going to be a big theme. So what should we do to pursue satisfaction? Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths." John 6, verse 35, "And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." And we remember that's what he promised the woman at the well in Samaria, wasn't it? He said that she wouldn't have to go to the well anymore. At least that's what she thought he said. But what he said was, you can have living water in your heart, in your life, if you will trust me. And the point is that we do not find satisfaction inside of ourselves. If we're willing to pursue Jesus and allow God to guide our paths, we will find fulfillment. And we will not otherwise, no matter what the people around us tell us. And I love the Hebrew concept of shalom, We translate this in our Bibles, peace, but the reality is that there's not an English word that correlates to shalom, because shalom means health, peace, and wholeness, and that's what Jesus wants to bring into our hearts and into our lives. Blaise Pascal was a famous philosopher. He was a mathematician, and he wrote, "There is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of each man, which cannot be satisfied by any living thing, but only by God the Creator, made known through Jesus Christ." And the problem with the world around us is that they will tell us that we can fill this God-sized hole by stuffing it full of garbage. And we can fill it, there's no doubt about it, but it will not really fill it. And so we need to choose wisely, don't we? Because if we choose poorly, we will still have spent the time, we will still have spent the money, we just won't have for it what we desire. Let's go to Genesis chapter 50. We're going to read this chapter, and then we'll have some thoughts on that. So, I guess I said we. I will have some thoughts on it, and you'll just have to listen to them. Genesis 50, "Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Now, when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, 'If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back.' And Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. And they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians.' Therefore its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So his sons did for him just as he commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now, please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household. And Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but the God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So this chapter begins with Jacob dying, and Joseph seems to have had the most emotion of all his siblings, and I'm not sure what to make of it, except to say that Joseph and Jacob had a very close tie. Now, Jacob was embalmed, and this was a big deal. Jewish people did not embalm their dead. What they usually did was place the body in a cave and allow it to decompose, and then at a later date, they would take the bones and put them in a bone box. And that way, I guess, they took up less space. You could bury a lot of people in the same space that we would bury one person in. So the Midrash, which is a whole bunch of writings way after the fact, that really is just legend, but I thought this was interesting, explained this by saying that Jacob was a righteous man, and so his body wouldn't have decomposed anyway, even without being embalmed. And Joseph apparently was afraid that the Egyptians would notice this, and so he went ahead and had Jacob's body embalmed so they wouldn't think it odd that Jacob didn't decompose. I don't think that's true at all. Jacob decomposed like everybody else. I think it's simply that it was a long journey in a hot climate to get from Egypt to Israel. And so they thought, you know, it's going to be a more enjoyable journey if Jacob is not decomposing on the way. All of Egypt mourned for Jacob 70 days. And I think this was a sign not so much of how much Jacob was respected as how much Joseph was respected in Egypt. So I don't know if you've ever been to a viewing or a funeral of somebody that you didn't even know, but you knew their family. And you thought, you know, even though I don't know that person, I care about the people who are related to them. And so I am going to spend a little time and tell them how much they appreciate to me and how much I'm thinking about them in this time of loss. I've done that myself. You probably have too. And so the Egyptians didn't know Jacob, but they knew Joseph. And they cared about Joseph. Joseph had saved their bacon. And they were appreciative. And so when Joseph's father died, they mourned for him for 70 days. Some have said that normal mourning for a pharaoh would be 72 days. So this was just short of that. It was a pretty long time to mourn. So Joseph got permission to take Jacob's body to Canaan to bury him. And it sounds like it was kind of a big deal to get this permission. Pharaoh depended on Joseph to take care of things. Letting him go for a month was going to be a challenge. And Joseph promised that he would return to Egypt after he finished burying his father. And there in Canaan, he mourned for his father for a week and then laid him to rest in the only land that Abraham had ever owned in the land of promise. So if you remember, he bought a field, but he bought the field because there was a cave in the field and he wanted to bury his wife Sarah there. So after all this was done, they got back to Egypt and the brothers were worried. So did Jacob really command the brothers to tell Joseph to forgive? Well, nobody knows. Jacob might have said this, but it might be as well that the brothers just were worried. And I suppose it doesn't matter. The real issue to me when I read this is that the brothers had lived with guilt and fear for almost 40 years. 39 years it had been since they sold Joseph into slavery, brought a blood-stained coat to their father and said, "Do you recognize this coat?" And they didn't lie. But they didn't tell the truth either, did they? For the first 20 years, they had probably worried that one of their siblings would spill the beans, would tell their father what they had done and would confess all, and they would all be in trouble. And when they discovered that Joseph was alive, they never believed that he had forgiven them. This despite the fact that Joseph told them that he had forgiven them. And the problem was that the brothers realized that they'd done something terrible, something that they would not have forgiven somebody else for doing to them. And so they could not believe that Joseph really had forgiven them. Instead, they thought, you know, Joseph has held off on punishing us because our father's alive, and he doesn't want to hurt Jacob's feelings, but now we are in big trouble. And another part of the problem was that earlier, while Joseph had told them not to worry, that God had used his hardships to bring salvation to their family and many other people, this had been Joseph talking, and they hadn't really asked for forgiveness or tried to come up with some reconciliation. Joseph did all the talking, and they were quiet. So Joseph got this message from his brothers, and he broke down. He expressed emotion. He wept. Joseph was somebody who had experienced terrible things in his past. And I've heard people talk about Joseph forgetting the past, but I don't think he ever forgot those days when he was chained in a desert caravan going to who knew what master as a slave. He never forgot the time when he was accused of rape and he'd been sent to prison thinking that he would never get out again. And having his brothers respond in this way brought back those memories in a way that he probably hadn't experienced in a long time. And he had to forgive again. And I think that's the way it is. When somebody does something hard to us, we forgive them. And then something happens, and we have to forgive again. And maybe we have to forgive again, and again, and again. And maybe it feels like it's futile. And so as Joseph talks about it here, he says that his brother's deeds were evil. It was a big deal. He doesn't underplay that. And it's important that when we are seeking forgiveness, we don't underplay the severity of what we did or the way in which the other person felt. The prodigal son planned a speech to say to his father, and he wanted to say, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants." He realized that he had squandered his father's money. He didn't deserve forgiveness. He deserved punishment. And Joseph framed the evil done to him. And this is often challenging to do. In Joseph's case, his brother's actions had led to him arriving in Egypt in just the nick of time to save not only his family, but to save the Egyptian culture. But the question is, what do we do when we can only see the evil that's been done to us? And I don't know the answer to this. Maybe all we can do is ask God to redeem the chaos in our lives. Joel 2, verse 25 says, "So I will restore to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the crawling locust, the consuming locust, and the chewing locust, my great army, which I sent among you." And I don't know what it looks like when God redeems the years that the locusts have eaten. But I do know that he is the master of you catastrophe. He's the master of the good surprise ending. And somehow he is able to take the suffering in our lives and make something good from it. He can somehow take the ashes and build a life that has value. And finally here, Joseph promised to take care of his brothers and their families. He had the right to make them suffer, but he had truly forgiven them, and this meant that he would do what he could for them. So finally in this chapter, Joseph died. And it's interesting, when we read in Hebrews 11 about Joseph, the only thing it says about him is that he gave commandment concerning his bones. And of all the other things that he did in his life, that didn't seem to me to be the big deal, but that was a big deal to the writer of Hebrews. But the point, I think, is that Joseph realized that Egypt was not a permanent place. The Israelites were not going to stay there forever. They were there. And that was where God wanted them to be for a couple of hundred years. That's a long time. That's almost as long as this country has been around. But in the end, God would bring them up with a mighty hand, and the Egyptians who stood in their way would suffer. Joseph had married into the Egyptian culture, but he understood that this was only temporary for his family. And so when his family left Egypt, they were supposed to take his body with them. And I've always thought this was a bit of an odd command. Whoever had the job of carrying this coffin along for 40 years through the wilderness probably didn't enjoy that job. But at the same time, this great man of faith wanted to rest with his family in the land of promise. And so we know the fulfillment of this. Exodus 13, verse 19, and Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. And then going to Joshua 24, verse 32, the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem. And the plot of ground, which Jacob had brought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. And I don't know what you think about when you read all this. When I was a boy, I just thought it was a weird thing. Why did Joseph give command concerning his bones? Why didn't his brothers give command concerning their bones? What about all the other people who died in Egypt and their bones just stayed there? I don't know. We don't have answers for those things. The only thing we know is that Joseph told his sons, and they passed it on to their children and to their children's children. They were not staying in Egypt. One day, they would be leaving this land for another land which was promised to them. And Joseph wanted his family to realize two things. Egypt is temporary. The land of Canaan is your home. And if this morning we have two things we need to realize, we need to realize that the United States is not our home, and we have another place we are going to. And if we get sidetracked and we think Egypt is our home, and we need to set down roots here, and we need to get involved with the culture around us and become a part, maybe we need to take an ancestor and put his bones in the backyard and say, you know, we're going to take him with us. Can't really do that. But we need to think about it. So I'd like to move on to the concept of leaving a legacy. So I've known a lot of people over time. And when I was working in Indiana, there was an ER doctor who seemed to have everything. He had a red sports car. He had lots of money. He always seemed to have a new girlfriend. And one day, he didn't show up for his ER shift. And he wouldn't answer his phone. And so the director of the ER, who was a really good guy, I knew him, he was a Christian man, he took another man, and they went out to this ER doctor's home. And they knocked on the door, and there wasn't any sound from inside. And they knocked on the door again, and they went around to see if they could check on a window, and while they were there, they heard a gunshot. And that man, who had everything, everything this world says satisfies, had shot himself. And it didn't satisfy. He wasn't happy. And he hid it. And he pursued the next thing, whatever that next thing was, that was going to bring him satisfaction. He had more than most of us here have, and yet he had far less. I've told you all before, but Zacchaeus had more after he gave away his wealth than he had before, because no longer was he serving it. So there are two things to contemplate here. What things really satisfy, and what are the things that people will remember about us? And I think these two things are linked. The things that truly satisfy are also the things that will leave good memories for the people that we know. So what was Jacob known for? What kind of legacy did he leave behind? Well, he had lots of sons and lots of wives, and the wives didn't always get along. Sons didn't always get along. He used deception to gain his brother's birthright and blessing. He was unbalanced in his love for his children, and we see this in numerous places, but he loved Rachel's children more than Leah's children, and he loved Leah's children more than the children of the maidservants. And maybe we remember a little bit about his prophetic nature. He did have a dream in Bethel about a ladder going up to heaven, God appearing to him and affirming promises to him. It was a mixed bag. What was Joseph known for? Well, he was the most loved of his father's children. This wasn't Joseph's doing. He didn't earn it in any way. He just was born to the right mother. But there's no indication either that he tried to use it to his advantage. He is known for suffering. So from the time that Joseph was sold into slavery until he became prime minister of Egypt, his life was one bad thing after another. He is known for forgiveness. So somehow Joseph was able to see a divine plan and realize that his own suffering had turned into the saving of many. He chose to forgive his brothers even though they didn't deserve it. It has been said that no sin is mentioned in the life of Joseph. And this doesn't mean that Joseph was sinless. Of course he wasn't sinless. But we don't have times recorded when Joseph did something terrible and had to suffer consequences for that terrible thing. And I don't know if you've ever been at memorial services where people sort of cover up the negatives from somebody's life. But what we know about Scripture is Scripture doesn't do that. So whether it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, all of them had their flaws on display for us to read and learn from. And if I had to choose which life I would live, I would choose Joseph's life over Jacob's life, even though it had much more suffering. And the verse that comes to mind when I think about Joseph is the verse from Isaiah 48, verse 10. Behold, I have refined you, but not as silver. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. So what is our legacy? I sometimes think about what would happen if you could attend your own funeral. I guess probably most of us will in a sense, although hopefully it's just a body there. But if you were cognizant of what's going on, and the people around you thought that you were dead, but you were there in disguise, and they shared memories of you, what would you think about? And I don't know they would tell you a whole lot. Most people at funerals do not share the bad things about the person. They usually try to focus on their better memories. But maybe the thing that would be most revealing would be the things that they didn't say. The times that you weren't there for them and they can't bring it up. The way your children would speak about your connection with them, or they wouldn't speak about that. So the thing is that each one of us has an opportunity today to decide what we're going to do, how we're going to live, because we will have a huge impact on how people remember us. Proverbs 13:22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. So maybe this is true from a material standpoint in the Old Testament, but if we think about it in the New Testament, I think this is mostly spiritual kinds of things. The apostles were all quite poor, and those who had children had little in terms of material goods to leave behind, didn't they? But they left behind something far more. So we need to live intentionally. Ephesians 5, 8 through 10 says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Spirit. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. After we meet Jesus, our lives should be different. They have a different direction. The New Testament talks about living as walking. Some of us are tearing around trying to get things accomplished. But we can only keep up this energy for a short period of time. I think the Apostle Paul would tell us, slow down. The Christian journey is a walk. And I think a lot of our lives are reactionary. We feel like we're putting out fires, taking care of lots and lots of chores that need to be done. Dishes are washed, and then they get dirty again. The same is true of clothes. You go to work, and the next day you have to go back and do very much the same thing. And you ask the question, am I accomplishing anything? When you mow your lawn, you know you're going to have to mow it again in a week or two, or maybe next summer. Hopefully right now it's next summer. And I had a general surgeon once who told me that he was a surgeon and he fixed people. And the unwritten thing that he was telling me is, you know what? Family doctors don't fix people. They see people over and over again for the same problems, and they're never better. And you know what? He was right. And yet he wasn't fixing people either. He was fixing one thing about the people. He'd take out their appendix or their gallbladder. But there was so much about his patients that he never knew, he never understood, and he wasn't fixing. And so I think we have a couple things to think about. First, we need to make sure that the things we do have to do, like household chores or work, we do in a way that is honoring to God. But second, we need to make certain that we live in such a way that people don't question what is really important to us. So I had a few different things that I thought about when I'm thinking about leaving a legacy. So first of all, I think we need to tell stories. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11 says, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." So the Bible's full of stories, isn't it? Those were my favorite when I was a boy. So they were stories about men who rose above adversity and trusted God no matter what. But on the other hand, there's a lot of stories in the Old Testament that are pretty bad stories, but they're not ones that we enjoy reading about. Rather, read about David until he becomes king of Israel and then just stop and not find out about the rest of his life. And I think all of us have a tendency to tell stories that make us look good. And maybe some of us have better memories about our past than others. But I think it's important, particularly when we're talking to our children, to our grandchildren, that we let them see the events in our lives that have helped us to develop into the men and women we are today. How did God build character in our lives? When were there times when I doubted and God answered a prayer? When was there a time when I followed my own desires and it didn't really get me what I wanted? Can I tell those stories in such a way that they understand that I'm not the person I am today because of chance or because I was wonderful from the time I was 2 years old on? I know my children know my flaws in areas where I don't measure up like I want to. But I hope that as I tell them stories, they understand that God is building somebody in me that is trying to draw closer and closer to Jesus. So tell stories. Second thing is be an example. 1 Timothy 4, verse 12 says, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word and conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity." 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, Paul told the Corinthians to follow him as he followed Christ. There was a basketball player in the 1990s named Charles Barkley, and he had a somewhat famous quote at the time where he told some news reporter, "I'm not a role model." And he went on to say that children should look to their parents and not to athletes to be their role model. Well, the reality is he was a role model for a lot of people. There were boys growing up without fathers in their home, and they were looking to see how he behaved, and they would behave like him. And Paul told Timothy that even though Timothy was young, there were people following him. There were people who were observing the things that he did and the ways in which he behaved, and they would emulate them. They would try to act like Timothy, even if Timothy didn't want that role. There's a song in the Christian hymnal that has a chorus that says, "Somebody follows you, watching the things you do, walk in the light and be pure in his sight. Somebody follows you." And that somebody may be related to you. It may be somebody completely different. And this can be a good thing, and it can be a destructive thing too, when we don't behave the way that we should. Third thing is build relationships. Proverbs 8, verse 24, "A man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." John 15, 12, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 11, "Therefore comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are, as you also are doing." So relationships are some of the most valuable things in our lives. I don't know that it is always either or. That is, it's not necessarily choosing between having more money in our bank account or having a good relationship with our children or spouse. But we have a choice, and if we have a choice, we need to choose relationships over possessions. So I recently read the book The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. It's an interesting book. It's written in the 1700s, around the time of the Revolutionary War. And one of the things that I thought was interesting in it was that Adam Smith says that when you buy something, the question is, how much labor does it take to gain possession of that thing? He said, "The value of any commodity, therefore, to the person who possesses it and who means not to use or consume it himself, but to exchange it for other commodities, is equal to the quantity of labor which it enables him to purchase or command. Labor, therefore, is the real measure of exchangeable value of all commodities. The real price of everything, what everything really costs to the man who wants to acquire it, is the toil and trouble of acquiring it." I don't know if that connects with you at all, but if you go out and you buy a new smartphone, what you're paying for that is not $960. What you're paying for that is the amount of labor it took to earn that money. And all of our lives, we are purchasing things with the most precious of commodities that we have, our time. And we can choose what we do with that time, don't we? If any of you have ever read Farmer Boy, Almanzo went to his father and asked him for a nickel to buy lemonade. And instead, his father gave him 50 cents. But then his father gave him this big, long talk that I think would have fit quite well with Adam Smith. And he says, "You know, this 50 cents, this is half a bushel of potatoes. That's how much we get for selling half a bushel of potatoes. And you know how much work goes into raising half bushel of potatoes," and he described it all the hoeing and the digging and different kinds of things. He said, "You know, Almanzo, you could take this 50 cents and you could buy 10 cups of lemonade, or you could buy yourself a piglet." So Almanzo bought a piglet. Sorry if that's a revelation to any of you who haven't read the book. It's a good book, but that's not the focus of the book. Piglet later gets into trouble. And I suppose that was a good investment. Every time we learn a skill or read a book, we have invested a certain portion of our lifespan in it. And the same is true of our relationships. And I've never met a person who, at the end of his life, said that he wished he had spent more time in his business or wished that he had a little bit more money in his bank account. But I've met a lot of men who said they wish they had a better connection with their sons, with their grandsons, with their wives. Apologize when you're wrong. James 5:16 says, "Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." Proverbs 24:16 through 18, For a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it, and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. So I was thinking about this interview with Donald Trump from back in 2015 came to my mind. And Donald Trump at that point says, I fully think apologizing is a great thing, but you have to be wrong. I will absolutely apologize sometime in the distant future if I'm ever wrong. And I thought, you know, this is kind of funny because he sees apologizing as a wonderful thing for everybody else. It's great. He'd look at all of us here this morning. He would say, you know, you all benefited from apologizing because there's been points in your life when you were wrong. And he could almost imagine a time in the future where he was wrong. And he thought maybe he could apologize at that point. But the greatest men and women were willing to fail and then to learn from those times when they didn't succeed. It's really hard to live your life pretending that you are never wrong. And you know what? The only thing harder than that is living with somebody like that. The Bible assumes that we will fail, but it also lets us know that God is faithful and he will forgive us. And more than that, he has given us a community of believers around us to encourage us and to help us on after we fall. In a family or a church community, the point is not that we have to be right all the time. I don't have to be right all the time, and you don't have to be right all the time, but we need to be learning all the time. And in order to learn, you have to be wrong sometimes. Sometimes the things that go wrong will be pretty minor. We're late for a meeting because we didn't plan well enough what time we needed to leave. But there's always a tendency for us to stick the blame on other people around us. So why is it that we struggle to admit that we're wrong? Well, maybe we're insecure. We believe that our value to other people comes from us being right all the time. And if we are wrong, then our value goes down. This is probably what was wrong with the Pharisees. They had to be right because the people looked up to them because they were right. And they could not think to themselves, you know what, the people around us will value what we say if we don't look good all the time. And Jesus called them whited sepulchers. He said, you look clean and nice on the outside, but you've got Joseph's bones inside. Maybe we don't realize the ways in which our actions affect other people. So this is a real challenge. And I remember talking to someone about their unwillingness to wear a seatbelt, despite the law asking them to wear a seatbelt. And they had all sorts of reasons why this was okay. But at the end of the day, it came down to the fact they didn't want to wear one. And they believed that if they were in an accident, they would be the only one to suffer. So if nothing else, the attitude that I took away from this was that their attitude towards authority was going to be detrimental to the people around them. They wouldn't really want the people who were under them to have the same attitude towards their authority that they had towards the governmental authority. And our children pick up on whether our lives are consistent or not. And I think something that's really important to realize is that people who aren't willing to admit their wrongdoing and their failures are often very fragile people. It takes courage and it takes strength to admit when you're wrong and to commit to doing better in the future. And this is also a way in which we can make certain that our failures do not become patterns of failure. So focus on things with eternal value. 2 Corinthians 4:18. While we do not look at things which are seen, but at things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So you probably heard preachers bring up the question of what you will care about 10 years from now. In some ways, this is a useful way of looking at things, and in some ways, it's challenging. A lot of things we do, everyday, simple tasks, we won't remember about in 10 years. So 10 years from now, you will not remember if you took a shower last night or this morning. The people around you might. 10 years from now, you probably won't remember if you did any laundry this week. But it's still pretty important to have clean clothes. So Jesus took things a step further. He didn't want his followers just to invest themselves in things that last for 10 years. He wanted them to think about eternity. 1 Corinthians 3:11 through 13 says, "For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is." The point is clear. Some things will stand in the day of judgment, and other things will not. And I think we understand the difference, don't we? Things we do for others, particularly because we love them and love Jesus, are the sorts of things that will stand. And things that we do for our own benefit in some way probably will not last. So kind of as a final thing, I would like to think a little bit about finishing well. And this is a challenge. Some of us are closer to the finish line than others. Most of us have no idea when the finish line is coming. There was a lady that I read about named Natalie Grabeau. She was an 80-year-old woman who decided that she wanted to train for an Ironman competition. And I have no idea when you're 80 years old why you would even think about that. I'm 51, and I have no desire to train for that. So what's an Ironman competition? Well, so it took her 16 hours and 45 minutes, and she swam 2.4 miles, she biked 112 miles, and she ran 26.2 miles, all on the same day. That would take me 3 weeks to do. She told reporters afterwards that she didn't even know how to swim until she was 59 years old. So she's a late starter. At some point in her 60s, she started training for triathlons, and then she went to this Ironman competition in Hawaii. And she was the oldest woman to finish the race. And there were 60 other athletes who did not finish. So finishing well. I don't know that that's the greatest thing to finish your life with, to say, you know what, when I was 60 years old, I decided I was going to start getting into long-distance running and biking and all this stuff. But each one of us has a time coming. The Apostle Paul, close to the end of his life, said, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." The Apostle Paul often used the concept of athletics in his epistles, and here he brings out the race. And I think so many people view the Christian life and focus on the start. The gun fires and you're off. And you run 10, 20, 30 yards, and then you stand up and you're done. You've won the race. Yay! I'm ready to be crowned. In races, there are often people they call rabbits. These are runners who set off and they just tear down the path. And then as they get to the first end of the first lap, they are giving out. They have no more legs. And they flame out. And I think of so many people in the Old Testament, kings of Judah, men like Solomon, Uzziah, Asa, and even David had wonderful starts to their reigns. And then towards the end, they got sidetracked and fell into sin. And as we think about our Christian life, we need to focus on finishing well. It is not enough to start a race well, not even enough to run the middle laps well. We need to finish the race. And this means daily maintenance of our relationship with Jesus, taking care of sin and distractions of focus whenever we see them cropping up. Joseph lived his life in a way that left a vibrant testimony for his children and grandchildren to measure up to. And I pray that we might leave the same sort of legacy for those who come after us. There's a song that says, oh, may all that come behind us find us faithful. May the light of our devotion light their way. May the footprints that we leave lead them to believe. Oh, may all who come behind us find us faithful. That's what I want for my life, what I want for all of you too.